mocking me. She locked me out and lost the key. And I've gone wandering again. I'm out the door, I'm walking by myself down the street like the night before. And I should be home in bed, but the notion in my head is telling me to ramble on. But every day is just a dream.
Hello, everyone. Hello. Hello. Thank you all for making this already a beautiful night. A room full of gorgeous people and gorgeous, generous food and soon-to-be amazing stories. I am Jenna Sobel. This is the wonderful Lily B. Please give her a warm welcome. Yes. I am so honored to be co-hosting with Lily B tonight. I'm going to stand closer to her. We both have the, like, we're like taking up space on the stage, but I like, it feels nice to be close. So Lily is an amazing storyteller. She's a Moth Grand Slam, that's what it's called, right? Grand Slam champion. I know. All expense paid trip to New York City for the Moth Ball in New York. So exciting. And if you guys are on the, like, Midwest area side, west side, she runs an amazing show at Rosa's called Rosa's Lounge called Stoop Style Stories. When is that?
Fourth Thursday of the month at Rosa's Lounge, 3420 Armitage. It's so great.
It really is such a good show. It's just kind of continuing all the love and joy there is around this kind of work and this kind of sharing. So thank you guys so much. I look forward to this so much every month. It's really nice to be with you. For those of you that haven't been here before, this is a storytelling show. We are featuring five stories from five storytellers that have been invited because we think they lead interesting lives and will have good things to tell you. Some of them are professional solo performers, stand-up comedians, and storytellers. But a lot of them are not. We feature farmers, cab drivers, doctors, lawyers, teachers, activists, all over the place. So tonight we have a great lineup. We also have five walk-up tellers, and we're going to tell you a little bit how the show works. And this is five out of, like, 12 people that signed up, so roll of the dice. With a K. Okay. All right? And if you don't spell that right, I don't count your vote.
All right, Erica. Also, when you logged in, along with that piece of paper, you were given 50 points.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you feel that? You have it now.
Anyway, you want. There's a couple of rules, right? One, you can't distribute more than 15 points.
1-5.
Yeah, 15.
Yep. I know, me too. All right. Yeah, that's it. That's it.
So again, I'm going to repeat the names. Make sure you have them in this order. Ben, Pamela, Nate, Stephanie, Erica are going to be our walk-up storytellers that we will bring up in between our speeches.
And the person out of those five that is given the most points by you tonight is going to return as a feature next month. So that's... The reason that we do this is because we want you to pick one of our features for next month's show. And our other features, as I said, are people who we think are interesting and live interesting lives. Tonight, they are going to be Kelsey Huff. Yes. Tim Whitting. Yes. Angelique Nelson. Irv Levinson, yes, and Nick John. So we're really lucky. Before we get started, a couple of etiquette things, potluck-wise, feel free. Easy.
It's just respect, you know, people need
to pay attention. Yeah, nice. But yes, feel free to get up even during a story. If you want to go get food, go to the bathroom, get a drink. There is no intermission, so feel free to move. And so we're going to get started. To start, I would like to ask everybody in the room, this is my favorite part, to find a person who is sitting close to you that you know less well than the other person sitting close to you, and make that person your partner. You have only 5 seconds to do this. Go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I know, this is my favorite part. Get him. All right!
I was on the bus.
All right, that's it.
Yes. Almost didn't count.
I love it. All right, everyone.
Is this just random people that are supposed to tell stories?
No, it's
5 features.
All right.
Say that again.
You don't pick random people from the
No. Okay, everyone, just a minute. Thank you. Okay. So, with this person, one of you in every group is green. You just know. Raise your hand if you're green. In every pair, one of you is green. See? All right. The other person is purple. Raise your hand if you're purple. People get really emotional about purple. They get, like, excited if they're purple. Okay. So, here's what's going to happen. Green, I would like you to tell a story to purple about only a 1 minute story about a time when almost making something like didn't count. So when you, this is a prompt, so whatever it brings up for you is fine. It's just a spark. A time when almost completing something, almost making something, almost getting, like it didn't get you where you wanted or what you wanted to achieve. Almost didn't count.
Yeah, almost didn't count.
1 minute, on your marks, get set, go!
It's me. I'm like, I
time. I just saw someone sitting in the audience that didn't have someone turned to them. Make sure you wrote people in if you see a stray. And I just was like, oh, I'll just go talk to this person. And her story is about the time that she almost got into the convent. Like, she studied there and, like, practiced and pursued it for 2 years, and then she didn't get in. So that's incredible. I can't believe I just got that. Your stories are amazing. Okay. So now, green, right? Green.
Purple.
Thank you. See how purples are? Purples are like, it's me. So Purple, you guys are going to tell a story about a time when almost was enough. Like, it got you in. Almost did count. So you got close, and that was fine. Whatever you needed. Yes. Yes. 1 minute on your marks. Get set. Go. That is time. We could sing. Harmonize. All right. That's time. That is time. That's time. I know. Purples, I tell you. Get endowed with the purple energy. All right, you guys, keep this energy going to welcome our first feature to the stage. The first person that you have up is a treat. It's Kelsey Huff. She is a Chicago-based solo performer and comedian, performing at lots and lots of venues all over the place. Her solo shows have been called a don't miss in Time Out Chicago, won the Boulder Fringe Festival Encore Award, received 4 out of 4 stars in the Chicago Stage Review, best solo performance of 2011. Kelsey hosts The Kates, an evening of women in comedy at the Bookseller every second Friday of the month. And she teaches a live lit class at the Story Studio. Wait, did I say that right? Yeah, Story Studio Chicago. Kelsey was a feature at the very first Here's the Story we ever had. 3 years ago. And the reason we picked her then, yes, and this is the last time we'll ever see her, so enjoy. Welcome her to the stage, please.
Yeah, if you can. I'm going to use the other one.
I do need it. You guys feel it? Feel it right here in the lower region? Bunkin' Bronco, you need a...
So moved by you.
You are? You're touching me, it's so weird. I know, I usually do stand-up, so I'm not used to this positive energy. I'm going to walk you to your seat, is that okay?
I see a fan, but she doesn't have a seat next to her, so now I feel really stupid.
Yeah, now you're going to have to stand and look like a real idiot.
Okay, I'll sit there.
Sit in that guacamole. Yeah. Well, no, they're a lot more drunk.
And a storytelling audience is like,
I know, you guys are so perked up. I love it. I love it. If you guys could yell, show us your tits and get off the stage, woman, I would feel right at home. Any snoozle. Okay, so let's get into this, right? Because I got 10 minutes. I got to stop rambling.
Six.
I got 6 minutes.
Okay.
10 minutes. Okay. So here's the deal. The spring holiday season is upon us, right? Many of you may be celebrating now, coming up, whatever. You're going to be spending time with your families. I'm going to be collecting all the Cadbury eggs I can. That's what I do. Delicious. But this year, my mom has guilted me into officially going back to the side of my family that I haven't seen in 17 years. Dun, dun, dun. Galooga, right? Oh, to grad school. I use things like Galooga. I didn't go to grad school. Okay. So, I haven't been back in 17 years because I come from a long line of drunks, you guys. Huge long line of drunks. And not that Russell Brand bullshit, you know, like, oh, we're trying to make it British and we're so thin. No. Like, I come from the guy with, like, old Milwaukee and, like, sucker punches, you know? Just, like, fucking violence. Tons of violence, okay? Like, the police were invited to most of our holidays. You know, like, my dad, my aunts, a lot of my cousins that come from a small town, they had their own little private cell in our small-time jail. My grandma made little pillows and, like, sleep. It was like an expensive slumber party, okay? So this is the kind, I mean, Huff, that's my name, Kelsey Huff. Huff, I come from a tribe called Huff. The onomatopoeia serves my people well. All right, we are Irish, unconfirmed. German, unconfirmed. Angry, big, fat, confirmation. You guys, so drunk and angry. That's the combination. Everyone's like, well, Kelsey, everybody has drunks in their family. You're just exaggerating, but here's the story. No example. My great-grandfather lived on a farm, a rented farmhouse. And in 1997, he made a bad batch of raspberry bathtub gin that set his house ablaze. Yeah, 1997, not 1897, okay? So for those of you who went to CPS, let me break this down. In 1933, prohibition there in these here United States was over. You could buy booze in 1997 legally anywhere. From convenience stores. It's easy. It's in the fucking title of the store. But no, why would you bother with all that convenience when you could whip up a batch of booze in your tub-tub, you silly gooses? So my grandfather, right, could not let go of his precious, burnt the house down with him alive inside it. Serious about their fucking moves, you know what I mean? So when I say that, people are like, okay, that's pretty bad. Why are you going back? I haven't been back in so long. Because the last holiday we all spent together as a family was so traumatizing. I put it over here, and it only recently came out doing the morning pages. Oh, it's terrible. So here we go. Let's do this. I love that you guys audibly moan for morning pages. They hate the artist's way. So here's the deal, you guys. Here's the deal. Christmas Eve. I spend like every other holiday, okay? The kids are on one side of the house, my grandma's house. The adults are on the other side of the house. Thunderdome, safe zone, right? So we as kids are just watching, you know, like clay reindeer and animated elf dentists, right? And the adults are in the parlor talking about fancy, sophisticated adult things. Like, this song's called Rudolph's Red-Nosed Reindeer. Why are all the other damn reindeers in this fucking song? It's his song. Why do you have a spotlight? And Prancer and Glancer and Blitzley, who gives a shit about the landfall? Scholarly. You know, the topic of education did arise only once, because at this moment, on this Christmas Eve, my Aunt Georgie, who was 16, decided this was the moment she was going to tell our whole family that she dropped out of high school. Now that's not as shocking as one might think. Out of my dad's brothers and sisters, eight of them, he was the only one to graduate from high school. The only one. My Aunt Georgie thought, I got a job, I got a car, who needs a higher education? Da-doy. The rest of the people were behind her, except for my dad, who believed in education. At the time, my sister and I were 6 and 4 years old, and he told us every day that you're going to college or we'll knock your fucking teeth on your fucking throat. We went, because it turns out fear's a real motivator, you guys. Okay? So that was going on. We're watching a little cartoon action. The adults are screaming at each other because all of a sudden my dad takes a stance. And he believes that education is important. My uncles and aunts are like, that's not even true. Look at us. We're doing stellar. No tooth, no tooth, big gut. They're not doing stellar is what I'm saying. So all of a sudden I hear some screaming, but I'm so excited about Christmas, I can't keep it together. So I run back and forth from Thunderdome to Safedome, Thunderdome to Safedome. And this is what I hear. I hear, oh my God, Larry, why are you making such a big deal about this? We didn't go to school. I don't know what your big fucking problem is. You don't know dick about dick, Larry. Why don't you get shut up? Shut the fuck up! Oh my God, Uncle Louie. Oh my God, what do you think Sam's gonna bring me? Because I think he's gonna be hungry, hungry hippos. What could be better? All those chopping and fun and the little marbles? What could be better than hungry, hungry hippos, Uncle Louie? In retrospect, adoption. Yeah, what is the big deal? You always think you're better than us, Larry. Where did you go? Great, go to like high school. If I can get a Mercedes, is that what you want? We want a fucking yacht. You want a yacht from high school? I don't know what you're even talking about. Oh my God, Uncle Louie, I don't even know where you're being, but I really hope I want Candyland. No, I don't. I want hungry, hungry hippos. Oh my God, Larry, why don't you shut your fucking kid up about these hippos? Don't you ever talk about my kid. My uncle awoke the bumblebee, you guys. My 6-foot, 280-pound father slams his beer down on the table and pounces at my uncle. Syrupy ham, beer foam, flakes of Christmas go everywhere, right? They're wrestling on the table. Wrestle, wrestle, punch, punch, break, break, punch, punch. My mom tries to tear the two men apart. Amateur move! Because she doesn't see my aunt, hot apple pie in hand, ready to defend her man's honor. My mom screams as pie melts into the side of her face. My grandma gets up, lights her unfiltered palm off, walks into the night, screaming, get your kids in order! The kids are not in order. The fight continues. Silverware smashes everywhere. The final floor ripples. The kids hide under the tree. Women scream. Men moan. The TV chants. Why am I such a misfit? Why am I such a misfit? No, my arm is not. Suddenly, a bone-crushing thud reverberates through the whole house. I look over, and I see my Uncle Louie's unconscious head fly through the drywall. My dad threw my uncle through the wall on Christmas. Ho, 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 what the? Santa's here! I jump up and run to Santa, trying to explain that they were bad, I was good, I should still get presents. Santa pulls my Uncle Louie's unconscious body from the wall, looks at my dad, who is just laughing and laughing, and he screams, you could have killed him, you asshole. Whoa, Santa swears. Santa also fights. He takes his large red satchel of presents and smashes it against my dad's body, lifts him up, and flings him out the screen door. He jumps on top of it, blood just spraying from his punches into the white, starry snow. Punching, 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 Santa Dad, Santa Dad, who do you choose? Who do you choose? Larry, what the fuck is wrong with you? This is fucking Christmas! Santa's sleeve starts to tear, exposing the tattoo that my he was in Korea. Bashes my head, my dad's head against the snow. Asshole, asshole, asshole. With each terrifying blow, his beard shrinks down, exposing my grandpa's wrinkled jaw. Oh,
dad goes limp, my grandpa has won. There is no Santa. My grandpa takes his Santa beard and tosses it at my dad. It is to be used as medical gauze. Stay out here and sober up and jerk him off. My grandpa pounces back in, takes the broken screen door, and tosses it like a defiant elf. He sees me, and he looks in the red sash, he's like, oh, yeah. I got that hippo game. Yeah, very good. 10 minutes later, my mom and dad were in the minivan. They're both holding holiday towels to their burnt, bloody faces, sparkly trees and blood. I never opened the hippo game. Hippos remind me of hate. Yeah, you guys, so this spring, while you are with your families, whether you're passing over, whether you're crucifying, whether you're just enjoying good old-fashioned capitalism and chocolate, or maybe you're a hippie, you like dig a hole and bury an egg and shit, whatever you're doing, I want you to think of me and pray for my safe fucking return.
Jungle, it was wet, you heard a lot of bugs, yada, 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 and there was overgrowth over the path. So we kept losing the path and then finding the path, losing the path, finding the path, and we expected to get to our destination that evening. There were signs along the way saying you're 20% there, you're 40% there. We saw the 90% sign, got lost, and then didn't find the path again. And we started walking, and we looked at the GPS, and it showed we were just doing circles. We had no clue which way to go. And standstill. And my sister's fiance, Andres, was like, we need to go forward. We need to go to the highway. No one's to pass that way. We need to go to the highway. And my sister and I were like, well, maybe we should go back. And then just at this moment, we're like, which way should we go? We heard this call.
Dynamo/of/Shakti blogspot.com, but ask me if you want to know more. Please give her a warm welcome to the stage. Hey, everybody. I'm going to avoid talking too much because I tend to ramble when I'm nervous. But I primarily do poetry, and storytelling is a whole other animal, so we're going to see how we can put those two together. When she was a girl, she was a shadow of a girl. Slight of her own spotlight, casting her into a corner. She did not want to be seen if she could not be heard, and it didn't seem that anyone was listening. Though told she was always being watched, judged, condemned for the way she stood, walked, danced like sin, she stopped making any sudden movements. Some days, most days, thought it'd be best if she didn't have to worry about ever moving again. So the story is going to be a little bit skewed because I only have 10 minutes, so large parts of the puzzle will be left out, but bear with me if you can get. I was raised under the will of a man saved by religion. My father, strict Christian, including all of the what we practice is more akin to Judaism in that we focus a lot on the Old Testament. For those of you that are unfamiliar, Old Testament God, kind of an asshole. So it wasn't hard to convince little me to fear it, God. You won't hear me call God him, so there's that. The hard part for my young mind was the paradox of having to fear and love something at the same time. Holy shit. The light bulb moment. I practiced this story many times before right now, and I just realized that is very much how my father's struggle is. And the insights, they just keep coming. Okay, so how to fear and love something at the same time. And, you know, when you're told that you are the reflection of something that you think does horrible things, how do you reconcile that? And when your father tells you that he does the Lord's work, but it just looks like all he does is hurt you and people you love, what are you supposed to think? So that kind of shit weighed real heavy, real fast on a young psyche. And my mother, patron saint of forgiveness for everyone else, I loved her for it, but might have been a more useful representation if she ever learned to forgive herself. So. Don't want to make it seem like my childhood was all doom and gloom. Like, there was, like, a lot of bright spots and sunshine and all of that business. But for the most part, naturally, I was a very anxiety-ridden child. Like, socially awkward, check, compulsive behavior, yes. And, you know, just a great depth and breadth of depression for the most part. And at 2 points in my life, I tried to, like, strike out for control. And I did that by refusing to go to school. The first time was when I was about 10, and then I was hospitalized when I was about 11 for suicidal ideation. That didn't last as long as it probably ought to have because, you know, with depression often comes equal amounts of guilt, and I didn't like the toll that I thought was taking on my family, especially my mom, so I just pretended that I felt better. And for a while, I pulled that off, but eventually it reared its ugly head again when I was about 13, 14. I again decided that I didn't want to go to school. And as much as I tried to hold shit together, I could in some areas, but most days it was just this struggle, this internal conflict. And, you know, it felt mostly like doubt and fear sit not so alone at either end of a battlefield facing one another. Not so alone because there is you, peering from the outside in, looking through the window onto the scene. They gaze at one another without blinking, unwaveringly, or so it would seem, but you could swear that their every glare was shot directly at you, piercing, asking, what are you gonna do? Seductive tender fear, she is upon your left, bloodshot red, the color of her nails, lips, blush, and low-cut, short dress. Her perfume smells something scarily reminiscent of your daddy's alcoholic breath, and in her anger and resentment threaded overcoat, there are two deep pockets. In one, all the shameful, embarrassing deeds everyone will someday they find out that you have done, and in the other, all the overextending, far too giving, back-bending, codependent tendencies of your mother, filled up tight with guilty zippers and buttons up to the neck, black, 6-inch stiletto heels she has slipped on and strapped to her feet to stress a beat around your mind while puncturing holes in your heart, holes big enough for every truth to fall through, the boy that loves you, the girl that misses you, every person ever got too close, every situation ever seemed too big, too hard for your small girl of 5'4". She walks in impossibilities and speaks in insecurities, tells you all those monsters under your bed, they are real, and if you try to fight them, you will fail, just like every time before. She used your every previous mistake to plead her case, never mentioning your successes, so all you know is yes, you will fall, yes, it will hurt, no, they won't care, this game, it isn't fair, but all you can do is stand there, too frozen to make a move. And that's what it was like, right? I pushed away, like, any friends or family that I didn't have to see every day because I lived with them, and I fractured a lot of those connections, and I spent most of my days like sleeping away the sunlight and up all night worrying about like how the situation was ever going to find resolution. And my mother, bless her, had her own mental instability and was trying to take care of four other lives, and so she kind of left me to like have some room to figure out that shit. And who knows how it might have gone, and you know, if I would have given in to those suicidal thoughts, except for by the grace of being up late one November night, when I was 15, 2004, and there's this show that used to come on called Inhale with Steve Ross, and it was a yoga program, and I watched it through, and it felt like, oh hey, that looks exciting. That may be something I can do. And so I did. I started getting up almost every day, 4 or 5 a.m., which is a miracle of miracles, because that was about the time I would be going to bed to practice. And, you know, hindsight, it gave me something to get up and do every day. But it gave me room in which to take action and move in a positive way that didn't feel like I could make a wrong decision, which is powerful medicine for a sick mind. And I don't want to make it seem like it was some magical feel that I woke up one day and felt better. It would be like many, many years, well, a few more years, but 3 more years. I would start to consistently see some light in my life, but you know, it just felt like a glimpse of, oh, this is what I'm meant to do. Like, our bodies, you know? Our bodies meant to fold like prayer hands, meant to hold, like this is important, meant to unfold, like letting go, not trying to will what will not be or is not yet ready to come, meant to be opened again and again and again, like holy books to be read and studied, like blossoms in season, like so many doors to let love in, like a window cracks and uncurtains to let the light in, to breathe in a sweet and flower scented breeze. Bodies like these, meant to bend over backward, bend unbroken, bend like refracted light, to teach your mind a thing or two about what it means to be able. And you taught me that, you know, here is something I'm able to do, without all the fear and the anxiety and like the crushing weight of doom of the world. And I was looking through my writing, trying to figure out what I wanted to share with you guys today. And there was just this huge gap of time where I stopped writing. I wrote pretty regularly from the time I was like 9 to 12. And then I stopped until I was about 20. But there's this one blip on the map dated about 6 months or so after I first started practicing yoga. And I thought I would end with that to share with you guys. Go with it. When you were born, there were wings growing on your back. They sprouted from your shoulder blades and spread out lengthwise past the reach of your outstretched fingers. I think maybe they were reaching for your dreams.
Yoga. I feel the same about storytelling. I listen to that and that her shirt. We knew my oldest brother, Victor, was her favorite. Just like we knew that me being the youngest, I was my dad's favorite. So I was the only one that he let sit underneath his ankles while we watched TV. One TV in the house, a couch, and a chair, dad laying on the couch, mom sitting in the chair, six other kids sitting on the floor. I'm the only one that he ever talked about when he went to college, when he go to college. I'm the only one that he stayed home with from work when I was too sick to go to school. I was the only one that when all the other kids flew out of the house, paired up, and made a play, stayed home with me. My dad would look into my sad face and reach into the pocket and pull out a dollar and give it to me and ask me to make some ice cream and cheer me up. So I'd crawl off to the dairy queen and get the biggest banana split I could get my hands on. So when the other kids got home, I'd brag about my ice cream. So, of course, they turn that around the next time you want to go. You say, oh, Dad will buy you ice cream. So, it worked out for all of us because I got to spend a little extra time alone with my dad, and they got to go play uninhibited by having dragons along with us. So it turned out to be a short-lived luxury. In our house, which is a long time ago, we had one phone that was tethered to the wall. And when it rang, everybody ran to get the phone to see who's calling. They all been taught how to answer the phone. The Glossky residents, who may answer the phone. It felt so important. But on one cold, rainy April 3rd evening back in 1974, the phone rang. It rang, rang, rang. It seemed like 20 times, probably about 5. My mom answered. And we wanted to look at her. I don't remember my mom ever saying what she'd just been told, but we could read it on her face that Dad had just been killed in a car accident. So everything changed right then, right there. I was no longer the apple of my dad's eye or anybody. The funeral was surreal. I mean, walk up to the casket and what looks like a wax figurine of my hero was lying there. And I knew that nothing would be the same after that. And I knew that anything and everything can change just that quickly. So I learned to appreciate every day and do whatever I could to get as much out of it as I could. Most of my siblings have remembered that lesson. They all tell their children that they love them. Because back in that era, that wasn't something that your parents said. You were just expected to know. But they all tell their children that they love him. And I tell my son that I love him periodically. But more often, I tell him things like, you taught me more than I'll ever teach you. I tell him in various ways how much I love him and what I've got, what his life has done to mine. My father dying, my son being born, are the two most important events of my life. In the way I look at it, it's, I guess it's okay for me to be my favorite, since he's my only one. But I don't know if that's coming up 5 minutes, but that's
favorite vote, so he's back as a feature.
teacher who was chosen by our audience last month. He's also, can I tell him? Okay, well, he came out, which is okay.
I came out on last story.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He came out on your last story. Yeah, anyway, he came out to be with us, even though he's feeling a little bit under the weather. So we'll give you a warm welcome, Tim. He spent the bulk of his working career in finance as a commodity market analyst. What does CBOT stand for?
Chicago Board of Trade.
He wrote his own newsletter on the psychology of the market. I would love to have a conversation. Last summer, as part of an experiment, he moved out to Glacier National Park to tend bar. He realized he could save enough money in doing this to live for the remaining 8 months of the year without working.
Clever.
How creative are we in how we organize our life? So, starting this summer, that is the cycle people follow. 10 bar, read, meditate, yoga, hike for 4 months, and then move to some cheaper currency place. That is his plan for now. Please give Tim a warm welcome.
And I'm curious to where this road will take me, so I hop in.
We drive down about 2 miles, and they drop me off at a rest stop. And shuffling under the car seat, before I leave, they hand me a brown paper bag filled with various candies, firecrackers, and Pokemon toys. I thank them and offer them my goofy Gaijin bow, and I take off, waiting for the next ride. Only about 5 minutes pass, and a younger Japanese man approaches me. He's in an all-night delivery, and he's going to stop. So he's going to go through Nagoya, so he tells me to hop on in. About an hour into the trip, he stops off to fill up his gas tank and comes back with a bag filled with Japanese dinner treats. He hands it to me, put it in my hand to resist, but he insists. They always insist. Every single ride that picked me up offered me a gift and insisted. But anyway, he drops me off at the Nagoya train station. And shortly thereafter, my hosts come by to pick me up and drive me to their home in the suburbs. Maki and Hirosho, a absolutely delightful middle-aged couple with two kids in high school and an excitable Akita dog. They strike me as a very traditional Japanese family. The next day, Maki and Hirosho take me to a Shinto shrine, which they describe to me as very nice and interesting. As I walk to the front of the shrine, I see before me, in this big, wide open space, 50 women, give or take, on their knees, hands clasped, bound to the shrine in the back center of the room. You can imagine my shock when I found out what is in the shrine. This traditional Japanese couple have brought me to a place where they're worshiping a 12-foot-long wooden sculpture of a phallus. I walk around the perimeter of the temple, and I'm struck by the male member in all its form everywhere you look. The peanut in all its glorious forms is celebrated. Right out, as you walk around the perimeter, you see these rectangular stones with kanji inscriptions of virility carved along the sides. You see this giant boulder with the top carved to be a phallus inside a body of water. And you even have my favorite was this little tiny penis with two giant marble balls on the sides spewing water out of it. And the best part, though, okay, is the museum next door. Okay, apparently, once a year, this little town outside of Nagoya has the world's largest cock festival. Literally, okay? You see mirthful men walking around carrying the giant shaft. A picture of a nice looking woman on a microphone talking to the crowd, looking down affectionately at her little baby penis. You see two older women sucking on their phallic lollipops, and an older man watching the parade festivities with his penis nose. I could go on and on about this, but I would not make my 10 minutes, so I'm going to fast forward ahead. To the next day, Maki and Rocha set me off my way. They give me a bandana with a Japanese flag, which I promptly tie around my head. And I'm so proud of it. And they also give me a cardboard sign for my next ride with the name of my destination and the Japanese, the kanji inscription. Whichever way the winds blow, so do I go. So they drop me off the bypass, and only about 5 minutes go by until a brand new red Jaguar pulls up. So, Yuma and Hirota, an attractive couple in the front, they tell me that they're actually going to be swinging by Yokohama en route to Tokyo, and if I don't mind sharing the back seat with Yuma's younger sister, Yoshi, I can hop on in. So after the get-to-know-thy-hitchhiker small talk, which you always have to encounter, I notice this shiny white iPod right there in the side compartment. And I asked if I can look through to see their music collection, and I noticed one of the most amazing 80s collections I've ever seen. We're talking Whitesnake, Asia, Mr. Big, everything, you name it. Next thing I know, Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child of Mine is blasted, and we're all singing along. I pass the invisible mic to Yoshi the Bat, and she absolutely rips the chorus. I mean, if Axl Rose was in Tennessee, the man himself would be first to offer respect. And so we're all just singing along, having a great time, singing to really good bad music, and we have no conception of time. But the sun's starting to yawn, and her stomachs are starting to rumble. Hiroto turns down the volume and asks, If I'd mind, if we make a slight detour over to the Miyake fixture, home of, according to many, the best cut of steak in the world. So, following the tradition of his predecessors, he insists on paying my way, and we do have the best steak any of us have ever had. Although this trip was my first foray into hitchhiking, it's something, the idea always appeals to me well beforehand. Not only because of its cost effectiveness and the democratization for travel that it entails, nor only because it's a practical exercise in letting go of control and trusting in the unknown. A tool enabling us to reshape our deeply wired perspectives of fear and scarcity by rebuilding a faith in nature and belief in her abundance. These were compelling reasons for sure, but the big push for me was the idea that I could meet so many people, hear so many stories, collect so many different experiences. I was one of the mad ones in the Jack Kerouac tradition. Mad to love, mad to live, mad to be saved, desirous of everything all at the same time. I just couldn't contain myself, y'all. That was almost 8 years ago. And although the reasons still appeal to me in some measure, over time I've come to a more subtle interpretation of the Hitchhiker's Guide to Finding Your Way. Many of us have heard some derivative of that Ernest Hemingway line. It's good to have a journey towards an end. But in the end, all that matters is the journey. And I think most of us probably not in agreement. It's all about the ride, right, yeah. But how do we put that into practice in a culture where time is money, where we're so primed in thinking in terms like efficiency and optimization and opportunity costs, where we tend to be so busy looking for the next experience, the next ride, that we often miss a big one. That ride built on the shoulders of an infinite chain of other rides, all collaborating to form this very moment. There's good reason y'all is called the present. The Hitchhiker's Guide teaches us to grab on to that sense of mystery and awe and gratitude that's within each one of us. It comes with a gift. Feel it and hold on to it tight, like your life depends on it, because it does. And with our 2 feet firmly planted into our past, and our thumb reaching for the heavens, let's gaze out into that pristine road ahead with that divine smile that knows the ultimate destination is here, right where we need to be.
Here today is what happened, and I should have prepared myself to 5 years ago, Lily, 10 years ago, Lily, because every moment is its own moment. And so that's what I got just from what you're saying. So I think that's beautiful. I think that's how we live. Just live it. Keep it simple. Right, Pamela? I don't agree. So I'm bringing up our next welcome storyteller. Another one that just came up to me and was just like, first this. I'm like, what's that? And he explained it to me. I'm like, all right. So I chose him because my nerdy co-host for Superstar Stories is here. And so I picked this guy for you. So enjoy him. Everyone, put your hands together for Nate.
Creature. So I'm way out of my
lead here. Like, these guys have been doing it for years. They've all leveled up. They're super powerful. I take one hit, and my chainmail armor, which is like 15 pounds, it's heavy, dudes, it's broken, technically, because it's lost all its hit points. So I run back to Sean, and I'm like, my armor's broken. What do I do? And he's like, oh, just use your blacksmithing skill and start tapping yourself and count to 60, and then it'll be fixed. Right? And I'm like, Sean, I didn't take blacksmithing. And he was like, you're fucking kidding. And then he gets so pissed off, and he starts going to tap me on the shoulder. Going, one, two, three. And I count to 60. I'm like, yeah. And I run back in, and the inset guy's like, 10 acid damage. And I'm like, shit, Sean. He was not happy with me that weekend. But what happens is by the second or third day, things start to change. Like, maybe it's the exhaustion from running around in the Michigan woods wearing chainmail for like 14 hours a day. Maybe it's the malnutrition from only eating granola bars and then hiding the wrappers in your boot because they don't fit with a bean. Or maybe it's like my vision is getting clouded because I'm constantly wearing my contacts because these are period. I remember on that the last night, we were like going down this crystal cavern. Walls were like faceted gems illuminated by phosphorescent mold covering the ceiling. And that's not where we were. We were in a field. Just a field, right? But like from the walls, these lizard men whose glittering scales match with the crystal, so you don't know they're there until they're split off. And they attack you with their tongue, which is a paralytic poison. Those aren't actually lizard men. I can remember they were the dudes in black, but this time with blue headbands. And they would run up and go, yes, four paralysis. But that physical memory, that surface layer reality memory, doesn't really seem important to me. The one that I remember is like literally being there, these crystal walls everywhere. Holy shit, they're basilisk people attacking us. And I'm like a warrior and I'm fighting them off. And Sean runs up to me and he's like, Nate, I think we gotta get out of here. And suddenly, like, I'm fully invested. And I'm just like, Sean, when our children tell stories around the campfire, you want them to say that the flame of Arrakis was smothered because one man's courage failed? No! I say as long as there's a heart in my chest and a blade in my hand, I will fight on!
One, there was a time in my life where I could talk to almost anybody. these Jehovah Witnesses coming by, doing like missionary work. They come on a Sunday or a Saturday, knock on the door, and I would talk to them. They would ask me, "Do you believe in God?" And I would ask them, "Is it true you guys don't drink Coke?" And this conversation just carried on for weeks and weeks and weeks. It was something I did. I like to talk to people. And that is until, like, my mom answered the door one day and the conversation was put to an end. The other thing you need to know about me is that I'm a little bit of a crazy person magnet. Which is odd when you think, well, I like to talk to people, or I used to like to talk to people. Case in point, when I first moved to Chicago, I was running late for the L one day, and I was in the foulest of moods. It was just awful. And it was probably because I was unemployed. I was late for something important, like an improv rehearsal. And it was one of those really hot, muggy Chicago nights where it was just inescapable. I was just beside myself. And as I'm running to the L, down the ramp into the platform, I pass by this guy that I recognize from around. And today he's wearing like torn jeans, he's not wearing a shirt, and as our eyes make contact with each other, they're particularly glassy. And all I can think as I'm running down is, oh, no. Because I'm just not in the mood today to talk to this guy. So I formulate this really quick strategy. I'm going to get on the next to last car. He's going to get on the very last car. He'll talk to some people there. He'll find some people to talk with. And I'll be able to stew in my dome juices all the way home. Or not home, into the town. Well, sure enough, as soon as the train pulls out of the station, I hear the door behind me open and close. And the thing I forgot to say is, the car I'm in, I'm the only passenger. Absolutely devoid of anybody else except me and this guy. And he comes, and he sits down right beside me, makes eye contact with me, and he says, "Hey! Can I give you a piece of fashion advice?" Forget my answer. It was, "What? Just gonna give you a piece of fashion advice. You could use a toupee." And I don't know, there was something in me that just snapped. I formulated another strategy really quickly, and that was to get off the very next stop and wait for the next train going in. And as I got off, he says to me, "You getting off here? You could have walked." Touche. So, over the last couple of years, and I'm sure we've all done this, those of us who take the out, you develop this strategy, this way of becoming invisible, right? You know, you develop this 50-yard stare, and it's kind of like the same strategy that toddlers have. Like, if I put a blanket over my head and you can't see me, I can't see you, and we're both invisible, right? And a couple of months ago, I'm on the L again, and it's a busy time. It's packed, and we all have that 50-yard stare, each and every one of us in this car. And this guy comes in, and he starts asking for change. But he's not just asking for change. He's trying to make contact with each and every one of us. He's trying to look us in the eye. He's not following a script. He's asking for change and trying to make conversation. And none of us are having anything to do with it. And he comes up to a woman who's sitting opposite me. I'll never forget this. She's well-dressed. Her eyes are closed. And he says, "Excuse me, lady, you got any change?" And she's not pretending to be engaged. She actually is unengaged. Her head nods. And he says, "Excuse me, ma'am, you got any change?" The book she's had it has in her lap falls to the ground. He picks it up. He says, "Excuse me, ma'am, you dropped your book." And at this point, her head drops a little lower, and drool starts coming out of her mouth. And he says, "Hey, there's something wrong with this lady here." Now, as luck would have it, the guy sitting beside me, also with that 50-yard stare, turns out to be a resident in one of the hospitals along the blue line. And he gets up, and in short order, he assesses her. Yes, she is unresponsive. Somebody else at the far end of the car is, like, phoning it in. And we pull up to a stop. And in short order, paramedics come in, take this woman out, book and all. And throughout this whole thing, I'm just sitting there. I'm frozen. I'm just a passenger. There's nothing I could have done. There's nothing I'm doing. And I look over at the other side of me, like across from me, and he's sitting there, the man who had been asking for the change. And he's got this sheepish look on his face, as if to say, it was my fault that the train had stopped. It was my fault that I had inconvenienced everybody. It was my fault that this woman had a seizure. And here's where my regret came in. What I wanted to say and what I couldn't say was, "I saw you. I saw what you did. You probably saved that woman's life. Thank you." But instead, I got out of the next stop.
I wanna fuck you for the rest!
to the south of the Negev Desert to work in a community that prided itself on exploring our inner humanity through silence. You know that you are approaching Ne'ots Mada when you see a giant sunset-colored mud phallus rising out of the desert. It is the lone erection in the pubic wasteland that is the Negev. And it is just one of the many incredible mud buildings that this intentional community has created together. Ne'ots Mada, we are told when we get there, is a phrase that is fairly untranslatable. This information is accompanied with accepting yet pitying smiles and the phrase, but maybe you could understand what it meant if you just get out of your own way. The community is beautiful and incredible, and they are quiet as much of the time as possible. They have created a number of buildings, the population fluctuates, and they have several different jobs that keep them going on site. So they run a winery, a goat dairy, and some version of like a healthy fruit roll-up factory. And all the food on site is grown there, and the meals are colorful and delicious. And the only people on site who are exempted from this silence and not expected to sort of join in the meals in the community are this group of hired Thai workers that they bring in to help on the land. When we first get to Ne'ots Mada, and periodically throughout our volunteer stay, we meet with a number of the original group members, including a man named Kobe. And so Kobe is this like older man, he's very handsome. Oh, I had a picture like a pre-chair Clint Eastwood. But like crossed with like a pre-autoerotic asphyxiation David Carradine. Oh, please don't groan. You should be so lucky to die with a lemon in your mouth. And Kobe had this habit where like he would ask you a question that made you really uncomfortable and then demand that you publicly discuss your discomfort. Which is charming. And like it took me about like a day and a half till I turned to my friend Hannah and I'm like, this place is definitely a cult, right? And Kobe's definitely the leader. And Hannah was being all measured, like, ooh, I don't know. And then by day three, she was like, oh my god, definitely. And so when I asked other members if Kobe was the leader, I would get this range of responses like, no, what? Maybe sometimes he's the leader. And many people are the leader. Why does he have to be the leader? What if none of us the leader? Or maybe I'm the leader. Maybe someone else is the leader. Are you the leader? Kobe was definitely the leader. The way that the schedule worked at Ne'ots Mada is we'd get up at 5:30, we'd all go together to drink these magical teas in silence, and then we'd kind of hop on the back of a tractor, go out to the furthest reaches of the property in the frigid desert pre-dawn, bundled up, start building a fence. By 7 a.m. we'd be like stripped down to nothing in the heat of the desert sun. Go back for a meal, come back out to work. After lunch, someone would stand up and say, you are now invited to weed the garden. You were never allowed to refuse this invitation, by the way. You were just invited, and then you went. That is what you do. And then we'd go back out to, my group would go back out to work in these apple orchards. And periodically throughout the day, we'd go on breaks because it was hot in the sun, and members would kind of bring tea, and we'd eat fallen pomelos, and everyone would sit in silence to show how comfortable we all were with silence. And then after the silence had extended for minutes, usually one of the members would interrupt to say, so how are people feeling about the silence? And then inevitably, some young volunteer, probably educated in the North American school systems, probably a private school with a need of fees, would say something like, it's just really interesting because I'm noticing a lot about myself because outside it's very noisy and here it's silence. I can think about it and that makes sense. So wow. Meyer, who's also 70 and lovely, and in this shop, they called it, completely unironically, the large wood shop, which was hilarious because it was the large wood shop was at the base of the giant mudcock shrine. And Meyer was this amazing man. He would constantly talk about how he wanted to be the best partner he could for this
ex-wife that he never named and who was clearly not there. And he thought that maybe this wasn't the right life for him, but he was in his 70s and it was too late to make a change. And sometimes I would find him playing the cello alone in his room at night. And after I would leave Meyer and after we'd eat a silent dinner, Hannah and I would go back to our room to go to sleep, and we would shove socks in our ears and pillows over our faces, because in this place of silence that was built to explore the peace of humanity and what is inside us all, it happened to be built right next to an Israeli military training ground. So all night long, we couldn't hear each other over the machine gun and cannon fire. I know guns have a huge sense of humor, you guys. And so in the morning, we would start again. And during our second week, I started deciding, well, like, if everyone's going to be so honest, I'm going to ask the questions I have. So during one of the moments of silence on our breaks, when suddenly one of the elders asked how we all felt about shutting up, I asked why none of the Thai workers were ever invited to join in breaks and given tea and pomelos and not invited to meals. Silence. And so I asked one of the members later, one-on-one, and her response was, eh, because they are paid. So my friend Joy and I just started, during breaks, beckoning to the Thai workers to just come over and share the tea and pomelos. And as we expected, all of the members would exchange glances, but said nothing. And at the end of our stay, Kobe gathered a whole bunch of the members and our group of volunteers, and he asked us all for our thoughts. And one of my friends outed me. She outed that I had written this piece basically about my disgust with the sort of dichotomy between the ideals of this place, of exploring ourselves and being the best people we could be, and the treatment of the workers and the refusal to acknowledge things that were going on just outside the gates. And Kobe asked me to read it. And so I obliged. And it was met with silence. And I know, I just want to declare before all of you, I know that we are all total fucking hypocrites, and me too, but just the difference, the idea of like locking yourself away and giving the world the gift of me exploring myself by refusing to engage with any of the world's issues right outside the gates that you were building enraged me to no end, which is maybe something that I need to explore further. In silence. And last year I heard that Kobe had died. And while I felt deeply for his loved ones, I also started wondering what this might mean for this community. And mostly I wondered what was happening in his last moments. Like, was he looking in the mirror, like, thinking that he did this really well and everything had gone incredibly, and he, like, put this baby palm up and just whispered, "Nailed it." Or did he actually doubt? Did he actually think about the Bedouins and the Palestinians right outside the gates and the Thai workers within, and even some of his own members who were longing for this world that had gone years without them? And if he doubted, did he say anything? Or did he just take it with him in silence? The night after we got back from the Old Smadar to our farm, I could hear, like everyone could hear, Ryan and Liz going nuts on each other. And for the first time in weeks, I slept for real. Because at least when two 20-somethings are having insane, wild, raucous, dome-pounding sex, at least I know, even if it's just for a moment, that one human being in this world is doing their best to make sure that another human being in this world is having it as good as they do.
Devastated by war or famine, and then she goes over and helps.
helps figure out how to support those communities and fix things. So that's a lot of her stories are from all different parts of the world, and I think that's kind of why. She's also doing something cool that I want to tell you guys about really fast. She and some other folks are creating a show called the 50th annual, is that
right?
It's the 25th annual Chicago's Liars Competition. And it's happening, it's storytellers, it's live-lit performers, it's monologists, it's comedians, it's people doing solo work, and it is, tell me the dates?
May 3rd.
So it's one night only. It's being judged by, like, religious leaders from all over Chicago. And it's taking place in a church. Where's the church?
It's Pensacola and Damon. It's right near Montrose and Damon. It's the Ravenswood United Church of Christ.
Cool. So she'll, like, have flyers and stuff afterwards, like people do sometimes. So talk to her about that if you're interested. Great. We have another storyteller. This is our last feature of the night. Irv Levinson is going to be coming to the stage, and he's such an interesting person to me. He began his career in the early 1970s as an inner-city teacher in St. Louis and Gary. He then spent 40 years as a trial lawyer, trying all kinds of cases throughout the United States, consulting in Japan, Australia, Sweden, Germany, Hong Kong, Mexico, and Canada. He earned admission to the United States Supreme Court Bar and has represented and tried cases in the Supreme Court. Irv has performed and trained at Second City, I.O. Gorilla Tango, Old Town School of Folk Music, and taught trial advocacy and international arbitration as an adjunct professor, it's kind of a tongue twister, to law students at Northwestern and DePaul. That's all. I'll let you speak for yourselves. It was great. Give him a warm welcome.
Love story begins, and if I could turn down the lights, which I can't, I would turn them down. And, miracles! This story begins on a dark night about 3:30 in the morning. And picture me now, 12 years old in pajamas, walking down the steps. I don't know what woke me up that morning, but something got me up in the middle of the night, and I hear some music. And something really astonishing is occurring down those steps. I see my father sitting on the floor, listening to music. Later found out it was Vladimir Horowitz's piano concert, great Russian pianist. And tears are rolling down his eyes. And I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, my God, what's happened to my dad? What's wrong? What's happened to our family? Is something horribly wrong? And I'm watching quietly on the steps. He doesn't look that sad, but there are tears rolling down his eyes. Sitting on the ground next to this Grundig Majestic, which was the big, record player, very fancy in those days. And I begin to think, maybe it's just the beauty of the music. And then I think a little bit more, and I remember the story that he told me about his mother, my grandmother, who I never met, who died when he was 18. She was a piano teacher, a musician. And now I have this image in my 12-year-old head. Maybe my dad was thinking back to the time when he was 12 or 10 or 6, sitting on the floor next to his mother's piano. And I didn't know if that was the case. I did know I wasn't going to disturb him, and I sat there looking at him, thinking. And when I went back up to bed, I thought more and more, and two things occurred to me. This man had a great, great love of music, because these tears were at least partially from this music that was coming forth. And that this man, who was my father, who I always thought wore his heart on his sleeve, had a side to him that I didn't know. A sadder side, a darker side, maybe a sweeter side, his music. And I began to think of him as a much more complex, complicated person. About a year later, I take another trip down those steps. My parents, I had turned 13, manhood. My parents gave me a rite of passage. My parents gave me my own bedroom in the basement of the house. My brother's sitting somewhere here. Up till then, I shared the bedroom with him. He was 5 years younger than me at the first time he ever heard me admit that I was the older brother. No longer my bedroom, but now I had a new companion in that basement bedroom. My father's library, ceiling to floor, wall to wall books. I had moved into his library, history, sports, religion, philosophy, down there on the floor where you least likely reach sex books. Give a 13-year-old boy a choice between philosophy and sex. Some of the time, sex won. Age 72, Nikki, sandy hair, losing her virginity. What a memory. My dad, I'm 32 years old, dies suddenly. The man who we all knew as Iron Man, because he seemed so strong, his back, his shoulders, his mind. No chance to say goodbye. And for the next year, I mourned my father by searching through those books and through his music, his records, the music he loved and he sang around the house. And I looked for him because I wanted to know the happy side of him. I wanted to know what made him sad. I wanted to know even the darker side, if there was one, and I imagined that there was. Well, I said it was a father-son story. I was the son then, but the fun thing about fathers, about being a son, is you may end up being a father. So we skip forward 20-some years. I have a son, his name is Josh, and I'm sorry, I have to skip 26 years of your life. But I'll tell you, they were fun years and good years. You know, we won't go into all the... Fathers and sons are like cardiac charts. You know why? because they are so much a part of each other, and also because they are so far apart from each other. There is a dynamic to father and sons that produces huge, huge highs and valleys, lows, just like that chart going like that. So we skip over 26 years of Josh. Damn, we had a good time. And some bad times and some rough times, like every father and son has. Now I enter my daughter. One day I have a conversation with her. She says, "Dad, I was talking to Josh, and he told me something very surprising." "Yes, Marissa, what was it?" "He told me that I was lucky. That I was lucky, Dad, because I knew you, because I was close to you, because you understood me and I understood you." That was like a stab to me. That was deep, that my son didn't understand me or feel I understood him, and the reason it hurt was it resonated, because that's what fathers and sons are. They hold things. They don't have the emotional intelligence of women. Fathers and sons are guys. So if we have this problem, there has to be an answer to it. So we plan a vacation, father-son vacation. He's 26 years old. I'm 50, 52, something like that. 49. And we're not going to just take any vacation. We plan a vacation to paradise. Paradise Island, Bahamas. Club Med, the wild heathen life of Club Med. I've got a little show and tell here. So on the plane to Club Med, to paradise, I developed this fantasy. This is going to be the best vacation ever. We are going to come away so close, knowing each other so well, that I become obsessed with it. And being a lawyer, I grab a lawyer's pad. It's the lawyer's pad I grab. And I start writing out questions. Questions that can be answered by fathers. Questions that can be answered by sons. The same question. And no topic untouched. And the unusual thing about these questions is we had never talked about any of them before. And in fact, I didn't know the answer to any of them. I didn't know the answer from his perspective. I didn't know the answer from my perspective. And I sit there writing and writing. Usually I write cursive. This time I wrote very neat, because I knew I wanted him to be able to read the question. We draw numbers and we pick a question. And we need to answer it. And there were 30 questions. 60 really all together, because each one could be answered by father and son. And I'm sitting on the plane and I'm thinking, what are the odds of this really working? 99 out of 100 chances, my son is going to laugh at me and say, "Are you effing nuts? We're going to sit here answering these questions?" Maybe only a 1 in 100 chance, but I had that obsessive fantasy. I wanted to try and make it work. So we get to Club Med. He's flying from New York. I fly from Chicago. We meet there. We go to this very Spartan, though hedonistic, room. There are two beds. He sits down there. I sit down here. And I say, "Josh, I've got a little game for us to play." Not much explanation, because I'm expecting him to be embarrassed, to shut up like a clam, to walk out of the room, to say, let's go to the party, whatever. From 3:30 in the afternoon when we got there, both exhausted, till 8:30 at night, at least 5 hours. And we never stopped. If he threw the question, he'd answer it, or try to. I'd answer it. Then, since we both happened to be lawyers, he was a lawyer in New York at the time, we'd like interrogate each other. let me give you a little example of what the questions were. They're 1 to 30. So if someone, anyone, will take the number 1 to 30. 16, did I hear? This was the only question in the whole group. We did talk about it, but Josh tried to take a pass, and I'll tell you what his answer was. I remember. And there's an I or a J by each question. The only notes I took, he didn't know, I didn't know I'd be talking publicly about it. The only notes was J, so he drew this question. Describe what you think your really authentic self is. And his answer to this one, we had asked like soul-wrenching questions. His answer to this one, I don't know if you remember, Josh, but it was, Dad, that's psychobabble. We talked some about it. A couple more moments. Three. Multiple choice. Something you felt when you were 10, 13, or 18. Pick an age. And since I chose 13, maybe we talked about my dad's library, because I know we talked a lot about my dad, and we had never talked about him before. Just one more to give you an idea.
Eight.
I guess I can't change this. It is what it is. Josh drew this one, and the question is, what are your thoughts about the fight we had the first day that we moved into our new home? That was quite a day. The one and only day when one of us or both of us may have drawn blood. And we talked about it. And it was important to talk about, because now it's 10 years after the fact, and it was still out there. So we talked about it. So our vacation in paradise was a vacation in paradise. We walked the sandy beaches bare feet. We talked about religion and God and mothers and girlfriends and sex and everything under the sun. And then the last day of the vacation, a woman came up to us with her. She was with her 16-year-old daughter. We had met her several times. And she said, you know, my daughter came up to me the third day of this trip. And she said, Mom, are those two guys gay? And the mom said, what do you mean, honey? Why do you think they're gay? She said, because the younger one always has his arm wrapped around the older one's shoulder. And I knew we were in paradise. About these vacations. And he said, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed our father-son vacations. Every time we have one, I learn more about you and more about how similar we are. You are my best friend. And I'll just conclude the revelation on how similar we were. One day at Club Med, we observed that we both deodorant. We learned that any other deodorant left us with perfume.
to our last walk up teller. And Erica, which is this? I'm thinking ice cream. Napolitano? Yeah, I did it. Woo! All right. She has more bites than Nexus. That's what she told me. And I was like, tell me about stuff. I have more bites than Nexus. I'm like, you cool. You're super cool. And she's new to Chicago and sounds like she's been here forever because she was just like, screw this winter. Right here in Chicago, like 3 months or something, like something crazy. And she already feels like all of us in Chicago. So everyone put your hands together for our last teller of the evening.
And on the coffee table,
After a few minutes, Phil decides to turn on his hospitality gene, asking me about my trip and if I'd ever been there before. And I said, "No, sir. I've never been to Knoxville before."
Knoxville? Knoxville? It's Knoxville, as in vulva, like the car.
This is the end. Yes. Hello. Yep. So if I could get Ben, Pamela, Nate, Stephanie, and okay. All right. Ben. We have Ben right here. Trapped in the jungle. Pamela. Heartwarming story. Nate. Where's Nate? Where's Nate?
I think they had to leave. I think Molly and Nate had to go.
Okay. Stephanie. And last but not least, Erica. Where'd she go?
In the back. And Nate was the one who had the sword.
Yeah. The prop. I try. It doesn't work. Doesn't work. Nowhere.
We want to say a couple of things. First of all, thank you all for being here tonight. Please, if you have food on the table, bring it home with you, because a lot of it ends up getting thrown away, because everyone's all like, "Oh no, you take it, oh no, you take it," and then no one takes it. So
I'll take it.
Please bring your stuff home. The other thing is, please talk to each other.
Yes. Yes.
It's a good way to make friends.
Yes, share stories all the time, even when you're not here. Share stories with each other. Irv will tell you it works. I'll let you know it works. I mean, share stories. Talk to each other. Stop being zombies.
Lock up, tell her that you choose. And the website is on the little ticket stub that you walked in the door with. Here's the story, Chicago.com.
And I feel it's important to say that if you signed up today and didn't get picked, come back next month. Please come back next month. Whoever's taking names, just say, hey, I signed up last month. You know what? It's a luck of the draw, but thank you, everyone who did sign up. Bye, guys. Thank you.
Cool.